basically, as they say, the classic model is ready, aim, fire. And you want to do that, but you don't want to aim for too long. And sometimes you just got to move forward and do. So the alternative to that model is ready, fire, aim, and re-aim until you get the system down.
Welcome to the Real Estate Monopoly Podcast. My name is Kerwin Donis. My brothers and I got into real estate investing to achieve financial freedom and help underserved communities in Guatemala, where our mom is from. Real estate is the vehicle we're taking to achieve our goals, and you can too. On this show, we share the stories of some of the most successful real estate investors to show you that you can succeed in real estate just like they have. Each episode, we deliver inspiring and educational content that will empower you to launch your real estate investing career and achieve your financial goals. Let's go. Mike Zlotnick has been a debt and equity investor in real estate since 2000. He started his career and has spent nearly 15 years in the information technology field, managing risk, business intelligence, and the quality of complex systems, softwares, and processes. While building a successful career in IT, Mike's passion has always been real estate investing because of its predictability of outcome and well-understood risks. In 2009, Mike joined Tempo Funding as a managing partner and vice president of funding operations. Starting from January 2014, Mike has assumed the responsibility of CEO and has since founded TF Management Group, launching four new real estate investment funds. Mike was born in Soviet Union, Russia. He came to the US for an education and a better life. Though he's always been passionate about real estate, he didn't start investing in real estate until the 2000s.
I come from Russia with love, as in James Bond. Well, originally I immigrated to the United States in 1989. It was still the Soviet Union. I don't know if you remember, but it's a different universe. But I've come to the States. I'm U.S. educated, mathematician by education. I spent almost 15 years in technology career and started investing in real estate in 2000 here in New York. You being from Queens, can understand the city. So I've invested mostly in the city and then went real estate full-time 2009, launching family of funds. And so I don't know. That's kind of a prior history.
That's perfect. I believe you have a background in IT as well. Is that right?
Yeah. That's what I said. I had almost 15 years of IT career, various positions, starting from rank and file and finishing career in, vice president type of roles, director and so on. And yeah, it was a fun journey, just a little different. My passion has always been real estate and I was delighted to go real estate full time in 2009.
As a corporate professional, Mike worked in IT for many years and had great success there. After growing tired of the corporate lifestyle, he decided to jump into real estate full-time in 2009.
So most, let's just call them engineering type folks, which IT attracts, started their career and then they at some point discover real estate. Those who do discover wind up making some investments, typically passive investments. Could be direct property ownership, could be partnerships with other folks, or could be syndications. You do multifamily syndication, so it's a great form to participate passively as a limited partner. And over time, you wind up with some portfolio of passive investments. But there comes a day where you realize that real estate is more fun. It depends, what you define fun. But IT career is obviously a lot of responsibilities, a lot of hard work, and it's a great career. Same time, I found that I really enjoy real estate projects. In 2009, it was the right switch time for me. I was a little tired, burned from the IT industry, and the opportunity opened up to jump full time, and that's the transition happened. So there's no right path. Every path is different, but for me, it was kind of that was the right timing. And there's no right way to jump into this full time either, right? Some people jump and they try to do some fix and flip projects. Some people jump into this and they try to do immediately multifamily syndication, but without working for other people. How do you do that? How do you know how to do it? It's challenging too.
Yep.
Yeah, so it's different for me. It was immediately into kind of funds and some of the lending businesses, but eventually we've evolved into commercial real estate, including multifamily, self-storage, industrial office.
As an immigrant, Mike has a strong work ethic and grit that has helped him succeed in his professional life and as a real estate investor. There are ups and downs in entrepreneurship, and Mike's background has prepared him for it.
I don't know if I thought about this that way. Typically, most of the immigrants come with the strong work ethics because you come from another country where typically life is a lot worse than the United States. So the challenges of that and the hard work you learn helps you study harder, work harder. So it's the work ethic kind of embedded in the blood. I don't know how else to put it. And that definitely helps. And then entrepreneurship and ingenuity and innovation is something varies person by person on what they feel. I certainly feel that I like the world of business, and it's been good to me, and it's a journey. It's like find the job that you like, don't have to work a day in your life. Find the business you like, and it becomes a journey.
When Mike made the transition from IT to real estate, he experienced a decrease in income. This would be a concern for most people. Losing a stable income was uncomfortable for Mike for obvious reasons, but he pushed ahead and knew he wouldn't go back to a job just for that security.
The transition when it happens from a technology executive career to real estate fund manager. One of the, if you want to call them, not fears, but one of the side effects is your income drops. You have a well-paying job with benefits and retirement plan and sort of, let's just call them, job safety and then and job predictability, and you go into business of sort of on your own. You eat what you kill. So you wind up growing the business, and which is a function of the revenues that you generate. So from that perspective, that transition is never easy because you don't know the certainty fall drops. So at that point, you have to be prepared to live on a smaller salary or smaller compensation or your own income, and basically start building a business, which one of the other big transitions is when you run a business, you're wearing all kinds of hats. You're not wearing one hat. So if you are a specialist, you are either an engineer or even a technology executive. You enjoy, you have a one. You're not jack of all trades. You're jack of one trade or maybe multiple trades, but they're still not all trades. And you transition into business ownership and then entrepreneurship. You wind up doing everything. You are the CEO, the CFO, they call the janitor, and the rank and file worker. So in a small company, you do many things, and that's one of the transition steps. Really depends on what you like. I call it, there's one expression, it's from an Asian culture. Do you want to be head of a snake or tail of a dragon? Right? So when you go, you become a business person, you're the head of a snake. And if you are working for somebody else, it could be a tail of a dragon. But what do you prefer?
As a member of one of the largest masterminds in real estate, Mike has built an impressive network. He started a thought leadership platform, and the name of it came about in an interesting way.
Big Mike Fund is the name of the podcast, and it's the website that we have. Originally it started as I've been a member of one of the most successful masterminds in the country for real estate investors called The Collective Genius. And I've been a member since 2012. So number of good old friends from the group, and I just came from that mastermind. I'm still a member today. I was thinking to start a podcast, and within the group, I go as a Big Mike. Sometimes they call me Big Russian, reflecting the origins or Big Mike.
Awesome.
Because I'm maybe I'm a tiny guy. I'm only 6'4", a little bit on the heavy side. And so the long story, they just said you're a fund manager and you're Big Mike, so go start BigMikeFund.com. which is basically the name of the website, but it does reflect originally was purely just a podcast called Big Mike Fund Podcast. I like to crack this joke. If you misspell it and you forget the D at the end, bigmikefund.com, you can go check it out. I promise it's not a kinky site.
Tempo Funding is the overarching entity that Mike oversees, and they operate multiple funds. Each fund offers different opportunities for different investors, allowing Mike to cater to different investors' needs.
We have a family of funds. They all live, our primary website is actually tempofunding.com, bigmikefund.com, which is a good catchy name. And that takes you to you know, a page where you could click around and proceed to our primary site, corporate site. We do have, at this point, three primary funds. One called Tempo Growth Fund, which is a growth-focused fund. We have a Tempo Income Fund, which is an income-focused fund. And we have a mix of growth and income called Tempo Opportunity Fund. So Tempo Opportunity Fund is a both strategies. It's an open-ended fund. Tempo Income Fund is an open-ended fund. Tempo Growth Fund is a closed-ended fund. The big difference is the closed-ended funds raise capital for some amount of time, and they close, and then they operate. For a growth strategy, a closed-ended fund is the only way to go. For income strategies, open-ended funds become a viable option. So what do we invest in? We invest in a broad range of asset classes and different strategies within each asset class. So I'll give you some examples. So Tempo Growth Fund really focused on maximizing risk-adjusted return and maximizing the growth of capital. Doesn't care about current income. So this fund invests into many heavy value-add multifamily. Let's just call them moderate to heavy value-add multifamily. Also invest in the hotel conversions to multifamily. It's been a very substantial part of our strategy. Value-add self-storage, which is conversion of an old retail to storage and such. And we have a number of other complementary strategies, but generally they all are not focused on immediate cash flow, but increasing the value over time through the forced appreciation, whatever the work. For an income fund, the strategies are very different. So we do hard money loans, we finance fix and flip projects. We do cash flowing syndications, income-focused deals, some shopping plazas. Obviously, multifamily falls into this bucket, self-storage, light value adds, or performing assets. So pretty much everything we do has some kind of value component. And then a mixing both. Asset classes, as I mentioned, quite a bit of multifamily, hotel to multifamily. We've got even some office conversions to multifamily. Self-storage, industrial. Industrial is generally pretty good for cash flow, and it's got some forced appreciation through lease escalations. Office, some really interesting projects. We have land investing. We have some projects where land gets permitted for cultivation of cannabis. It's a land play. We're not growing. We're not running a pot farm. Just investing in the land, getting permitted for cultivation. So there's a few complementary ideas, but it's a broad range of asset classes and strategies.
The original fund Mike was involved with was used to finance single family projects. Despite the success Mike had doing short sale flips, he eventually expanded into the commercial real estate space.
We started originally, the very original fund was started as a fund to finance short sale flips. So during the, it was started effectively in 2009, and it financed those flips. If you remember short sale flips, when there was a crash of 2008, market bottomed out and started coming out of the heavily depressed. A lot of short sales took place. People, a lot of folks we've known for years, or we build our relationships with them. They locked up the property on the short sale. The banks were extremely incompetent evaluating these properties, and they were agreeing to prices that were somewhat below the market. But the banks had the opportunity to reject those deals, but they approved them. And then the investors took those properties, and then they flipped them. So short sale flips became basically double closing transactions, and we finance transactional funding. It's a short-term loan. You buy from a bank Well, you buy from the owner with bank approval for 250, sell for 300 or 270, make the $30,000 or $50,000 spread. Sometimes it was really back-to-back flip, finance some of those. So that whole business didn't take a lot of capital because the money rotated fast. We've raised initially, you know, off the top of my head, a million and a half, which is sufficient for that business, from friends and family. And anytime you want to go raise capital for any project, who do you go to first? You always go to your friends and family. You always reach out to, if you say you got no friends and you got no family, well, and that's a problem, right? But you typically go to your inner circle, your close sphere of influence, and that's where you raise the capital first.
As a fund operator, Mike likes to say he marries money with opportunity. Mike employs this sentiment when he builds strategic relationships with investors and pairs them with investment opportunities that meet their needs.
Sort of nowadays, I do a good amount of deals, and I'm sort of known even within the Collective Genius Mastermind as the guy who structures deals. So that's what comes down to. We have a team, we have our organization, obviously. But I'm networked with a lot of operators, basically people with deals. And I mentioned the Collective Genius Mastermind plus a number of other masterminds I've gone to in relationships with Bill. People have come forward with a deal flow. And there are both institutional level operators and some I would call them kind of mid-range. We don't work with newbies at all. We're basically working either with institutional level or folks who are a little bit below that, but they have a decent organization. They reach out and they're looking for capital. And sometimes they have existing sources and sometimes they don't. And if they do existing sources, those have limited supply. So we're working on a deal right now where an operator reached out. They had a deal where they needed multifamily capital raise around 5.8 million. They have about 1.8 million of their own money, and they came highly referred, recommended, and we agreed to raise them $4 million for their deal. So we went through the deal, went through the underwriting. We liked the deal. We liked the operator. Then we took a step back, and we have a network of investors who are looking for additional projects. And also structure the deal in a unique manner. There's some folks who need outside depreciation and some folks who don't need any depreciation at all. It's an advanced technique that I'm a big fan of. Obviously, it needs to be done within the IRS compliance, but you could raise the capital for the deal and you can also make it a lot more efficient. Those who need more depreciation get more depreciation. Those who don't need, like IRA investors, don't get any. And then there typically needs to be an equitable or appropriate shift of benefits as a result. If you do it properly, then the reallocation of depreciation to those who need it is appropriate because they take more risk because they are subordinate to the other money. But to make a long story short, deal structuring is just as important as raising capital. Most investors don't realize, they just think, hey, let me put everybody in the same bucket. They all get proportional depreciation. And it's a wonderful idea. Many people do that. But sometimes a little bit more creative approach can be a better approach. So marrying money and opportunity is basically that. Finding great deals that we love to invest in. And then on the other side, it's looking for folks with capital and then matching that capital with opportunities. Some folks, again, I was really interesting enough at the Collective Genius Mastermind, a lot of those guys are real estate professionals. And then they basically need depreciation. So it was almost a queue of them all talking to me saying, Mike, when is your next project comes out where we could get outside depreciation? So there's a need. And then basically you match the need with the opportunity. I know those guys need the project with this type of structure. While some other folks have IRA money, they couldn't care less about depreciation. They would rather have better economics in the deal. So that's what I mean by marrying money and opportunity. It's not just the money, but the kind of money and they need. And again, I don't give advice. I'm not an investment advisor. We structure the deals. Investors make their own decision. If this fits their criteria, wonderful.
Having a fund is a great option for an investor. Though there are pros and cons to using a fund, Mike uses funds because they allow him to use multiple strategies, and take advantage of the plethora of opportunities that come his way?
I answer this question. I have a book out how to choose a smart real estate investment fund on Amazon, a number of white papers. Yeah, the topic is obviously very advanced. It's not a trivial topic, but the real basic answer is typically you do one-off syndication because it's easier to explain. It is easier to finance. It's easier to understand. So one-off deal makes total sense. You found a property, think it's a good deal. So you do one property. The fund, and then there are different funds, right? We run a family of fund of funds. We'll hear the term fund of funds. What does that mean? It means that our funds invest into multiple strategies, other deals. We can invest in a fund. We can invest in the syndication. We can invest in the partnership. We can own a property outright. So funds of funds are more diversified vehicles, and they work for those who have ability to understand multiple strategies. They work very well for me because this is what I do day in and day out. There are also funds that are run by specialists. I have a number of good friends who have very specific single strategy. For example, we've invested with some of them. So we have a number of folks who invested with a specialist in storage. That's all they do. And there are folks who are specialists in light value at existing cash flow storage facilities. So they buy multiple of these properties in the same vehicle, and that's a fund, that's a storage fund. Similarly, I have a friend who invests in distressed commercial debt here in New York City. That's all he does. So he has a fund that does just that, buys non-performing notes and mortgages secured by properties in New York City. That's a specialty play. So these single strategy funds become an option to go in versus a single deal. So why fund versus syndication? Well, fund provides generally some degree of diversification. Broadly diversified funds, broad diversification. Single strategy funds, still diversification, but within the strategy. Why you do it? Because you want to spread the risk. You never know when something is going to be a home run or it's going to be a strikeout. That's why people invest into the funds to mitigate the risk of a single asset having problems. Because if you basically, you could have a great deal and you can get outsized return on that deal, and you can have another deal completely fails. If you do it within a fund structure, you may wind up with a decent average. But if you picked one deal and you picked the wrong deal and you took it on the chin, then you lost all your appetite and you thought the world is nothing but that one loser. Fortunately, this is how it works.
No, that's very good. Good.
No, I was just going to say the funds, there are other benefits and drawbacks. It's not a perfect world. As I said, it's easier to sell a single syndication because you know the closing date, you know how much capital there is, you know what's in the deal, what's in the strategy. With a fund, there's another important element. So when you invest in a deal, typically you absolutely underwrite the sponsor. You want to make sure you know, like, and trust. But you're also underwriting the deal to make sure that it fits your economic criteria. With the funds, you primarily underwrite the fund management team, which is similar to the sponsor, the matter of speaking, but you're not underwriting deals because you don't have control over what deal is going to go in the fund. So you could still review what strategy the fund invests in, understanding that, but you're not directly seeing specific deals. Sometimes the fund manager will show you what's in the fund, and that may give you a little bit more visibility into specific assets, and sometimes they don't.
Not all operators are equally qualified, and Mike doesn't do deals with just any sponsor. Real estate is a relationship business, and Mike leverages his existing relationships to source great investment opportunities for the investors in his funds.
Investors, so typical accreditation requirement, you could use a third party compliance. We use our fund administrator, Verivest, to verify accreditation. In general, as a fund manager, you want to make sure that investors are vetted through a third party. Again, if they're U.S. citizens, you're not required to do a number of checks that you do with foreign citizens, anti-money laundering and anti-fraud, anti-terrorist checks. So typically, third-party administrator, as long as they do those services, and if you have foreign investors, you can also screen them that way. For the U.S. investors, typically, accreditation letter from a CPA or an attorney does the trick, or they can get verified through the fund administrator. That service is also third-party, like verifyinvestor.com. So investor vetting is a little bit less of a process. What you do want to make sure you have kind of a match from what you feel is going to be truly passive investor, not going to drive you nuts five days a week asking you, how's my investment doing? So as long as you feel that investors are not overly proactive and asking a million questions and writing you a small check, it's really fascinating. Somebody writes you $1 million check will often ask you less questions than somebody who writes you $50,000 check. So pick and choose your investors, obviously, to the best of your ability. At some point, you may take investors in and then you may not like them and you will have to redeem them out if it's the redemption mechanism. On the other side, you have to, it's a whole process. The sponsor vetting is not a trivial process. I can tell you that it's taken us years to develop this relationship. Trust takes years to develop, and it's observing people for many years, how they work, how they communicate, how they bring up deals, and how they deal with problems. It's not a trivial process. You can obviously run some formal due diligence, some background checks, and track record checks, and so on and so forth. So there's a process to this, and then there's a deal level due diligence. Even after you clear they just call them sponsors and operators. And just to be clear, we don't even take cold inquiries at all. We need to get a referral, somebody who we know. If there's no referral from a known party, that trusted party, and you bring a most wonderful deal, we're going to say thank you, but we're not going to spend any time on this because our time is precious. And unfortunately, there are a lot of great and shiny objects, and even the time to review is a precious time. So the point is, whenever you're trying to build a relationship, find a referral point, referral or reference point. So we start, once the reference is there, the background is there, then we go look, once the sponsor is sort of vetted, at least initially, we'll look at the deal. Does the deal make sense? And the deal underwriting is a little bit of a science, a little bit of the art, obviously. So science from the mathematical perspective, the projected rent increases if it's multifamily, the projected, you know, cap rates compression if you see a trend, if you're underwriting conservatively based on current cap rates or where the trend is going, or even assuming cap rates expansion a little bit for safety reasons, and then rent increases. Number of sponsors observing today as a result of the COVID, the rents have been jumping, right, a lot. So is it sustainable? And the answer is probably not on a long-term basis. Accelerated inflation is only good for some amount of time. So there's mathematical underwriting, and there is actual asset underwriting. There is also the area itself, type of asset. You can have a wonderful theoretical strategy, but if you're dealing with a Class C asset, then it's very difficult to run, and you don't have the ability to execute that strategy. Then it all works well on paper. In practice, you're going to fail because managing a difficult asset is an art of its own.
Fund managers are compensated through an established compensation structure. Mike brings a lot of value to the operators and investors he works with. As a fund manager, he's compensated for the time and effort he's put into operating the fund and building the relationships with his trusted sponsors and pool of passive investors.
As a fund manager, typically the funds themselves have a compensation structure. Typically they have what is known as a management fee. So it varies fund by fund, but typically the fund management fee could be anywhere from, you know, there's a range, but we charge 2% typically, and that's within the norm. I've seen funds charging 3%. I've seen funds charging 1.5%. Some funds charge 1%. It really depends on what it is. 2% seems to be the norm. Depending on, again, the fund and the structure, there may be an acquisition fee. So we charge a relatively small acquisition fee, and it's 1%. One of our funds does not charge an acquisition fee, for example, Tempo Opportunity Fund. So in general, the fee is appropriate and adequate because there's work involved. And then you have a performance on the back end. So the funds have what is known as a waterfall. So waterfall is a structure where there's a seniority of cash flow and seniority of distributions exist. Some folks confuse the waterfall, the pref with the guaranteed payment. It is not, just to be clear. So give you example. Our Tempo Growth Fund has a waterfall where we do collect 2% asset management fee and other expenses get paid. After that, the investors receive 8% next. It's the preferred return. And return is cumulative, meaning that if it's not paid year one, it accumulates until year two and so on. And then for closed-ended funds, the waterfall typically includes return of capital after the pref. So once the pref is caught up, then there's a full return of capital. And after that, there is a performance split. So performance split depending on the fund and the class of units. So Tempo Growth Fund has two classes of units. It has an A class of units, 80-20 split, and a B class of units, 70-30 split. All that means is that once investors are paid their pref, the capital is returned. For every dollar that the fund generates above that, that money is split. So investors in class A receive 80% of the upside, and the fund management company receives 20% as a performance fee for getting the investors at least 8% return. So the performance split is what generates additional fees for the fund management company called performance fees, and an additional return to investors. So when you hear, again, using an example of Tempo Growth Fund, we target to our investors' average annual return of 12 to 18% on average. And it's a range because we don't know, there's uncertainty. And the fund pays 8% pref, then return of capital, and then it's an 80-20 split, as I said, or 70-30. So that 80 or 70% of an upside is what takes investors into that range between 12 to 18%. It's 8 plus additional that bumps them up to 12 to 18% return based on the mathematical model. Some funds and market conditions could be such that these numbers could be drastically outperformed or underperformed. So just be clear, none of this stuff is guaranteed. These are projections. And if you catch the right wave, you could easily outperform these projections. And if you're in difficult market conditions or you select a whole bunch of bad deals, you can underperform. And that's kind of how it works.
Yeah,
so
no.
The primary fee is management, asset acquisition, performance.
Throughout his real estate career, Mike has had to work very hard to find great investment opportunities for his investors. Reputation is important in the multifamily space, and Mike has been committed to protecting his investors and vetting any deal before presenting them to the investors in his fund. His experiences have prepared him for the role he fills today.
I would say that the most difficult thing, the most difficult part of the journey is, in the most important part of the journey is selecting the right deals. It's once you find the deal, once you underwrite the deal, once you put the deal together, a lot of hard work has been done. So I think that I could have done a lot more, a lot better in the early years getting involved. This seems to be my strong side. So I've been doing it in the last few years. I could have been doing it many years earlier. So it's not a regret, but it's more of a kind of realization that I was an LP for too many years, just the LP, and I could have captured a lot more upside on these deals by being co-GP and structuring the deals. So this is where we are at now. This is where the journey has taken us. And deal participation and ability to structure deal, if you have the talent and you can put together all the elements of the complex transaction, you can benefit quite a bit, and you can basically generate yourself not just good returns for investors, but substantial wealth building by participating in the deal economics as a partner or co-partner.
Mike is currently operating multiple funds, which serves the company's passive investors and keeps them coming back. Mike also continues to work with sponsors and scale at a pace he and his team can sustain.
I think life is a journey. Enjoy the ride, right? There's no right or wrong stage. Everything is a stage. So we're at a stage where we've done and continue to do a good number of funds, and that becomes sort of our vehicles for investors to participate. But also we've evolved quite a bit into individual deal structuring and co-GP And that's where we are at. We're building a portfolio of these projects where we are co-partnering, co-GPing, and continue to go deeper and deeper with the right type of sponsors and operators. And I don't know whether there's a clearly next, big next. As we go along, we basically want to make sure we bite or we can chew. You could have great ambitions, but in this business, you can't, it's not a, you know, it's not a technology.com where if you've got a great platform, your user base can exponentially grow. Not quite. In real estate, growth 20, 30% a year is sustainable. Can you grow at a higher rate than that? You can, but it becomes growing pains. You have to rebuild your team and so on. So we're enjoying, you know, good incremental growth. And that's where we're at today. Sure. So like any business, you're trying to build businesses you can essentially sell one day. And it's not that you want to sell, but you typically have a business that can operate, I don't want to call it without you, but you certainly need to provide leadership for the business, but day-to-day platform of your business should exist without your active intervention. So you want to work on your business, not in your business. So build a scalable and sustainable business that is fun for your team. It's really important, I guess, the cultural thing, as most folks who go into this, they got to have the right core values, the right culture, so that the business, everyone involved in the business, they feel culturally close and fit, rather than when I was in the IT world, we really never interviewed somebody based on their cultural fit. It was mostly based on skills. Can you program in Java? Can you do this? Can you do that? Right. And now it's almost the opposite. So building a business that has the right people and it's culturally fit and it operates ongoing. So the vision is to build something that, again, not for the purpose of sale, but something you could sell. At the end of the day, the enterprise value of your business could be substantially greater than just the book value of the assets you've accumulated. So that's kind of the vision, is to build a business that can be sold as an enterprise or merged with somebody. And ultimately, the investment platform that people would like to invest and recommend to other folks, as this is a good wealth path, the path to their wealth, freedom, their economic independence, and so that's the way I think of it.
Fear of failure is normal, but it shouldn't be what holds someone back from taking action. Mike is a big believer in taking imperfect action, and if he hadn't taken action, he wouldn't be where he is today.
There is no right or wrong. Don't be afraid to fail. Basically, as they say, the classic model is ready, aim, fire. And you want to do that, but you don't want to aim for too long. And sometimes you just got to move forward and do. So the alternative to that model is ready, fire, aim, and re-aim until you get the system down. So that's what the business is all about, is to figure out what works. And until you figure that out, keep pushing forward and take action. That's probably the most important thing, is to take action rather than look for perfection.
To learn more about Mike and get access to the content he puts out, here's where you can go to do that.
The website is bigmikefund.com. And in general, if folks have capital to invest and they're interested to chat, reach out. Head of Investor Relations will be delighted to chat with you. If you have deals you want us to look at, find the referral chain. If there's no strong referral chain, I will apologize. It will be difficult for us to spend time. Unless you want to pay us, I do coaching. There's a bigmikecoaching.com. It's a paid gig. Folks are interested. I do coaching, and I have to be happy with the student. I need to make sure I like the student as much as it's not about the dollars paid for me, but if somebody reaches out and I enjoy the conversation, I feel that I'll be able to help them, they can sign up. I'm not a cheap date, just to be clear.
Thank you for joining us today on the Real Estate Monopoly podcast. If you got value from this episode, please do us a favor and give us a good rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Or if you'd simply tell a friend about the show, that would help us out too. Make sure to visit our website at www.donisinvestmentgroup.com/monopoly, where you can subscribe to our newsletter so you'll never miss a show. If you want to avoid the top 5 mistakes passive investors make, you can also check out our free ebook by going to www.donisinvestmentgroup.com and downloading it. Be sure to tune into our next episode. Until then, take care, guys.